All right, here we go. Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Sutai Vampyr and Jajim Vestai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome, warrior, to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Joe Jim.
And hopefully I'm Jorn, assuming you've got me turned on.
I do.
Good.
Yes. And today we are going to look at Faces of Fire, a novel by Michael Jan Friedman, published in March of 1992. And John, why don't you give us a brief summary of the plot for this?
Okay, it took me a while to come up with the brief summary of the plot because this particular book is $600 to buy in a paper format. So I had this is my first shot at trying to use an e-reader. So I had to find some place to find the plot summary on the back of the book because there ain't no back of the book on an e-reader.
No, there isn't.
Now, having said all that, en route to Alpha Malorian 6 to settle a dispute between two religions, the USS Enterprise first stops to do a routine check on the progress of a terraforming colony on Beta Karzanda 3. A colony whose inhabitants include Carol and David Marcus. Spock is left behind at the terraforming colony to continue his scientific studies, and the rest of the crew heads to Alpha Malorian 6 to find the dispute has turned to war. As Kirk, McCoy, and Scotty search for a solution to end the conflict, a ship piloted by a Klingon faction arrives at the terraforming colony to take control of the facility. When colonists are imprisoned and Spock and David must defeat the Klingons or face certain death. Now I'm going to say that's probably supposed to have been where colonists are imprisoned, not when.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Memory Alpha is not always the greatest.
Yeah.
They're kind of a Wikipedia site.
All right.
That was the back of the book.
Yes. So what overall impressions did you have?
Why does every ambassador that comes on the Enterprise that's supposed to be doing a mercy mission have to antagonize the Enterprise crew?
Particularly Captain Kirk.
Oh, my God. Can't they get along with anybody? I mean, that should be, okay, first course in ambassador training, getting along with James T. Kirk. Well, come on, guys.
I agree.
Study.
Well, and not only that, but, you know, we have a Federation ambassador aboard a Starfleet ship, and he's not thinking about anything except his mission. And they always seem to want to ask Kirk to do this weird stuff. You know, well, we've got 40 people a minute dying on this other planet over here. I don't care. That's not my problem. I've got to go here and solve this little dispute. You know, it doesn't make any difference to them, you know, that Starfleet is an arm of the Federation, but for ambassadors, they aren't very diplomatic at putting forth what they want.
Nope. No, they are not. They are commandeering in putting out what they want.
Well, trying
because
to,
anyway. They basically want to take over the ship and make the ship do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
I get drawn back to the Armageddon Factor. I believe that's the name of the original series episode, where you had another ambassador who was working with Kirk, and they fall into a situation where the planet, the two planets they're trying to mediate between, are at war. But mm-hmm. they're at war in a sense, in a computerized sense, so that nobody actually gets killed. They have to, when they're dead, according to the computer, they have to walk into a death booth and die.
Uh-huh. That was Ambassador Fox.
And somehow, before the end of the episode, Fox and Kirk are getting along.
Well,
they find a way to work together.
Well, the tables turned in that one when two guards from the planet grabbed Fox and started herding him towards one of the death chambers.
Oh, I thought the landing party was immune from the death thing because of where they, you know, where the attack occurred. It was the Enterprise.
Yeah.
That was supposed to come down and be destroyed.
Oh, well, yeah, the crew had been hit. So, but they were using the hostages to persuade them to do that. So, but I mean,
I'm just using that as an example, though, of, you know, there is a way for ambassadors to get along with Kirk if they'll just work with him.
Yeah. Well, and
but we never seem to see that.
Yeah, and then there's other commanders who come on board. Matt Decker was one, and I can't remember the other guy that was a commodore and star in of a starbase, who, you know, took the ship over and just about got everybody killed.
Before finding out that there's not much that a starbase can do that a starship can't. I think that was paraphrasing one of his lines.
Yes, with the right man in command.
So.
All right.
Why can't we just have an ambassador that comes on board and... Okay, I take it back. There is one. There is one ambassador in the books out there.
Yes.
That does do this. And that's Curzon Dax.
Oh, then that makes two. Because not too long ago, we read a book that had another envoy from the Federation, and he was he was part Romulan, he was part human and part Beta Zed, I think, or no, part Vulcan, human, and Beta Zed. You remember that one?
Okay, no, I don't.
Oh gosh, I can't remember his name, but they traveled all over the place because of this ambassador. Ezri Dax was commanding a ship and ferrying this guy back and forth, and there was a mining issue, but I can't remember the title of the book.
Yeah, there aren't too many books with Ezri in command, and I think it was part of a series of books. But
yes,
I can't think of the title either.
Yes,
the book that we're doing next has Curzon in it, and yeah, he takes care of things
mm-hmm.
competently.
Ah, all right, your next point.
Well, this is the first time I've ever read a book using an e-reader, and it took me a while to figure out how to use this thing. First of all, it took me a while to try and figure out how to turn the page. Then there were, I don't know, it's just, there is no manual with these things, it seems like.
No, there isn't.
So how are you supposed to know how to do this stuff? Apparently, you can change the size of the print. And I really haven't figured out how to do that. It just pops up accidentally. And there are times that it literally changed the print down to where I couldn't read it. And I'm sitting there trying to figure out what it is I did and where I pushed and to try and get it back so I can enlarge the print again.
Mm-hmm.
Or the book at the bottom of the book page, it would tell you how far into the chapter you were or how far into the book you were. And every now and again, all of that info would just disappear, and I had no idea, no clue how long this book was or anything. It's just,
mm-hmm.
like you say, maybe the more experience I get with ebooks, the easier it'll be, but boy, this was not a pleasant experience. The book was fine. You know, the story was good.
Mm-hmm.
The reader was a real pain in the keister.
Well, as you said, they most generally don't come with very detailed instructions, and you're kind of left on your own.
Or any instructions.
Right. You can go online and find specific instructions, and usually there is a book included on an e-reader that give you more specific instructions on how to do things. So you can open that. Usually your ebook comes with your the book on uploaded that has the instructions, and you also have a dictionary, usually. Okay, now my only experience is with Kindles. I have found very easy to run. The first thing you got to remember is, if you're experimenting with it and trying to figure out how to do things on your own, you're not going to hurt anything. It's not going to blow up or go to pieces, but it can be frustrating.
I can't put that stick of dynamite, tape that stick of dynamite to the back and light it?
I wouldn't advise that.
Oh, okay.
All right. So
it gets frustrating enough.
Now, there are alternatives to Kindle. There are very good alternatives to Kindle. For instance, you can go to Amazon, download the Kindle app on your computer, and you can download the books onto the computer and read from your computer. Or an iPad is another good way to do it. I have an iPad mini that is devoted to nothing but Kindle books. I keep it in my backpack so that if I'm stuck somewhere, I can just grab a book and start reading. So, and most generally the rule is if you want to turn the page, advance, you touch the right side of the screen, and if you want to go backwards, you touch the left side of the screen. And as far as the numbers at the bottom that you mentioned that tell you how far you are into the book and things like that, if you touch right in that area, you can change it to the time left in a chapter, time left in a book, where you are in the book as far as the location number, or even page numbers. There's a couple of different formats, just depending on what you have.
This is the first time I've been using this Kindle, so I'm trying to figure out how it knows how many more hours I have to read this book.
Okay, well, that's because when you first open a book, and if you look at the bottom, it will say learning reading speed. And as you...
It does?
Yes, it does. With a new book that you've just opened, have never opened before. And you start reading, and as you turn the pages, the Kindle itself will determine your particular reading speed, and then it can calculate about how many hours or whatever you will be till you get to the end of the book. Usually it comes up with that in about 3 pages.
Boy, it must hate me, because I have a habit of maybe getting done with the first page and then, okay, how long is this chapter? And I start flipping.
Ah, and yeah, and that will mess up your estimate, but it estimates the entire time you're reading the book. So when you go back, it'll probably speed you up, but then as you continue to read on, it will adjust and eventually reach it's pretty accurate for the most part.
Okay, yeah, I did notice that on the bottom of the book.
Yeah.
And another thing I noticed on this, and I think we talked about this privately before, this book has no gaps between segues.
Mm-hmm.
Normally you've got, you know, a couple of blank lines or some asterisks to let you know you're shifting POV, but
yep.
Not this one.
I completely agree. No scene breaks whatsoever, and it was very distracting at times. You'd be reading along, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're reading about Spock and David on the one planet, and it moves to the next planet with no warning whatsoever. I think that's book formatting.
Yeah. But it could have easily been eliminated if the book editor, the guy that formatted it, would have just left. Because I'm assuming that the editor, or Michael, put the spacings in.
Yes.
Because that's just how you write. Don't take those out.
Yeah, I'm sure he included those, but it just depends on who typesets the book. Now, typesetting now is all done on computer, but before it was up to someone to sit down and set the type before the plates were made.
Typesetting basically is taking the individual letters and setting them into the holes in the plate that you're using to print. Mm-hmm. Hence, there's the name, typesetter.
Yeah. Well, then later on, of course, it became a computer application where typesetting was done on a computer.
And unfortunately, sometimes you're seeing spell checking done by a computer.
Uh-huh. So, you know, it would have been really nice if there had been some delineation between scenes, you know, an extra spacing, some kind of symbol, anything would have really helped a lot.
Yeah. So you're not reading along going, Spock and David were climbing up the hill. The Klingons on the bridge.
Yeah.
Well, what?
It's aggravating.
Where'd they come from?
It's aggravating to get halfway through a paragraph and they say, what? What? Where are we now?
Because you don't see at the beginning of the paragraph the names of the characters to know you've switched.
Yeah. Well, I know that all of the books that Mike has published himself through Crazy 8, I do know they are formatted very well. So that wasn't his fault.
Yeah. So. Well, Michael's a professional writer. Michael knows how the reader is going to read his book.
Mm-hmm.
A computer doesn't really care. It's going to get the letters down, period.
Right. Yeah.
And by letters, I mean the number representation of the letters that the author put in.
Yeah. Well, we should probably move along. What is your next point?
Okay. This book comes basically 10 years after David Marcus's introduction, well, Carol Marcus, his mother also, introduction into the Star Trek universe, a.k.a. Wrath of Khan. And basically, David Marcus is a doomed character.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see him die off in the next movie right after Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we going into the backstory of a character that we're just going to kill off and not going to have any real importance in the Star Trek universe?
I'm not sure I can answer that very well, but I can say that as a reader and as a fan, I kind of enjoyed seeing some backstory on him, what kind of kid he was. And we see in this book that he was a very intelligent, unique person. So
only to be knifed by one of the characters in this particular book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then again, we get that scene in the Genesis cave where Kirk is saying, I did what you told me. I stayed away. And okay, where did that come from? I didn't know where it had come from. It was just, okay, well, it's there. And this book plugs a lot of holes that we got in Wrath of Khan.
See, the problem is when you see that line that Kirk throws out, Nicholas Meyer didn't have the ability to go back and do a backstory because Carol knew what happened. Kirk knew what happened. They're not going to tell each other what they both know happened.
Right.
So the audience doesn't get to know what happened.
Exactly. Well, and Spock and McCoy knew also, we find out. And there were hints to that in the movie also.
So, yeah.
So it fills in the gaps from before. So, and you have one more point.
Captain Krug, at the end of the book, is running away. And based on the character from Star Trek III, I don't see him running.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, he just took command of the ship.
Right.
But, my God, he was itching to take command of the ship because they weren't doing things his way.
No, but then he was third officer. And inexperienced as a ship commander, you know, and my take on it was he was leaving to live to fight another day. Cause
I didn't see that as a character for Krug. He just,
yeah. Well, people change.
He would just fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you I don't, know, I don't know.
In Star Trek III, he literally, kills his girlfriend. Because she read something she shouldn't have.
Right.
But she needed to read. There's no way she could not have read it. But
that's 10 years later than this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So who knows? You know, more backstory on Krug wouldn't have hurt. But not for this book. Okay. My overall impression.
Because he's a minor character until the very end.
Yeah. My overall impressions, I enjoyed Friedman's treatment of this story. I thought it was fun to read about the relationship between Carol and Kirk. The movie left me with the impression that they were at odds, but Kirk did mention he promised not to interfere with Carol's raising of David and why Kirk was not surprised to see David in the Genesis cave. So, you remember David come running out with a knife and he was going, or a knife or some kind of tool or something, was going to part Kirk's hair with it, and Kirk knew who he was, more or less. So that answered that for me. We also get a look at the younger Krug as an officer serving on a Klingon ship. I found this interesting, but I would have to have learned more about how Krug became Lord Krug later on. Kirk had a chance to prevent a future problem by destroying Krug's ship on the way back to aiding Spock, but instead headed back to the colony because that was his priority.
Well, the thing with Lord Krug, the only way, my understanding is, the only way you're going to be a lord in the Klingon Empire is if you're already nobility, you know?
Yeah.
It's a title handed down. That doesn't mean that Krug, a.k.a. Lord Krug, would still not be third officer on a ship because, let's face it, I think even in the British military, they start at the lower ranks and have to work their way up.
Oh, yes. You bet. So that's very true. So this book, it was about the awakening of the Genesis Project, and it shows how Krug could see it as a weapon even when it was in its earliest stages of development. And it also explains how he got involved with Star Trek III. So, yep, Genesis. We're already going with Genesis. We call this one, in this book, it's called G7. So it must be a seventh prototype for what eventually would become the full-blown Genesis machine, or torpedo, as Krug refers to it. Overall, I enjoyed the Klingon versus Federation story. We really saw some ruthlessness from the Klingons. However, I have to say that the other part of the story, I did not care for that much. The trying to mediate between the two religious, or the religious faction and the non-religious faction on the other planet. That, I'll tell you what, it totally was unforgettable to me.
Well, more forgettable because the whole basis for what's going down is so minor, so ridiculous, that in a sane world, you're just going to see it, react to it, and put it behind you and forget about it.
Oh, did I say unforgettable? I meant it is totally forgettable.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Oh, that makes more sense.
Yeah. It didn't really motivate me other than giving Farquhar, the Federation ambassador, the vehicle to irritate Kirk, which ambassadors all seem to do, as we talked earlier.
Yeah, it just seems to me that it's just taking the Indian religion of, the sacredness of cows to an extreme concept.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that. So our characters, we don't have all of the crew members of the Enterprise involved this time. We have only the ones we need: Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Scotty. So I appreciated just the ones we needed. And then we have Carol and David Marcus, Ambassador Farquhar, the other children, and other scientists.
Now, he does go on to name them, but yeah, they're pretty much just nameless characters, even though they're named.
Yeah. So
there's only one that has any kind of motivation that we see, and that's the kid that decides that he has to go back to the colony and give himself up.
Yeah. So, yep, nobody else, none of the others, wanted to do that.
Now, for those listeners who are trying to figure out what the hell I'm talking about, the Klingons came down. The Klingons imprisoned the scientists, but the kids were out on a field trip, and Spock was out doing something also. So they weren't captured immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Word got to them that if they didn't come back, it wouldn't be pleasant for their parents. So one of the children decided to actually do what the Klingon said and came back and surrendered himself, where the rest of them followed David's ideas and hid themselves in the hills, where they met up with Spock and developed plans to resist the Klingon invasion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I think let's move ahead. I know you have a point that you, a bullet point under things that we wanted to talk about.
Star Trek has a predilection for numbering planets from their stars instead of giving the planets names. All right. Okay, I can see that. Except when the planets, like the planet of the Holy War going on, is inhabited, and the inhabitants of the planet should have named their planet.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Earth shouldn't be Sol 3 when the Federation comes to visit. It should be Earth.
Uh-huh.
So why don't they come up with an actual place name for these planets if there's an intelligent race already occupying them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this has crossed my mind also. We do have in Keith's books, the Gorkon series.
Keith DeCantio, by the way, for our listeners.
DeCantio, yeah. We have a planet name from the people that were there. It was called something else by the Klingons until they got there and found out what the name of the planet actually was. And they started referring to the planet by its name. So that's, you know, it happens that way. But if you're from another system and you come and visit our system, first of all, our star may not be named what we named it, which is Sol.
Right.
Okay, so first of all, it's going to be something something number 3, which would be our planet, third rock from the sun. And, you know, when the aliens arrived here, then we would explain to them, oh, that's our star, we call it Sol. We are the third planet from that star. We call this Earth. Okay, and there you have it. And that'll change. But yeah.
And then here's another thought too. Why are you numbering them from the sun?
I don't know. Why not?
When you're coming into the system, wouldn't you number it? Neptune's the first one, then Uranus, then Saturn, then Jupiter, then Mars, then Earth.
No, I would start closer to the star.
Well, it depends.
Because it's deeper in the gravity well.
But it's a long way from that beginning point.
Not an impulse, it isn't.
Well, it still takes years for Voyager to make the trek.
Yeah, well, that's Voyager. What do they know?
Well, they know enough to link up with the Borg and become V'ger.
Yeah, there you go.
That's a new fan theory, by the way, is that the Borg were the ones who upgraded Voyager to make it V'ger and send it back.
Interesting. I don't...
Well, they're a machine race.
I don't agree with it, but I can, you know, the Borg, I can see the Borg fixing up V'ger, but, you know, the Voyager probe, but not necessarily the Voyager ship, because we saw the resolution of that anyway.
Well, if the Borg upgraded Voyager along its route back to Earth would have been upgrading itself with anything it came across.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would have learned from the Borg to assimilate.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
But that's a topic for another fan theory discussion, not part of Faces of Fire.
No. So, I have...
Where the hell did he get that title?
I don't know. I'd have to think. I hadn't even thought of it. Got to call it something.
You got to call it something, but why Faces of Fire?
Hmm.
Oh, well.
Good question. Maybe
moving right along.
Maybe I'll shoot him an email about that. All right. So I'm having trouble myself understanding this whole Alpha Malurian 6 part of the story. Okay. It serves as a vehicle to leave Spock behind on the other planet, trying to figure out how to deal with the Klingons. Okay. But why would the Federation want to get involved in a holy war between two factions on a sovereign planet anyway? Once again, out the window or out the airlock goes the Prime Directive, and the Federation takes it upon itself to solve a problem That was none of their business.
Weren't they? Wasn't this planet part of the Federation? And weren't they invited in to deal with it?
It may have been. But even when the Federation is invited, I don't think you are supposed to meddle with people who are having issues on their own planet.
Okay, now you're sounding like Picard. And this is Kirk.
Right. Well, yeah. And, you know, cowboy diplomacy. We know exactly all that about with Kirk. But at the same time, not only has Kirk messed up the timeline numerous times, as we find out in Deep Space Nine, but
yes,
he has.
When the time agents come in.
Yes. And he has the biggest disregard for the Prime Directive.
Despite him bringing it up as often as he does.
Yeah. I mean, he's always getting involved where he shouldn't get involved. And, but of course, you know, it's Captain Kirk. He lands on his feet every time. So
yeah,
that's the nature of episodic television. So I don't know, maybe going to this planet might've been just a large plot device to, so that we could deal
occupy two thirds of the book. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So we'll talk more about that in a minute. Now, how do we keep, you ask, how do we keep Jim from finding out about his son?
Okay.
All right. Did you, normally, John, I know you well enough to know that if you ask a question, you usually have an answer.
No, not this time.
Oh.
Because this was one of the motivations for the book. I mean, they're trying to keep Kirk from finding out about David because that's what Carol wants. And every time somebody makes the deduction and figures it out, she's there saying, please, please don't tell Jim. Please don't tell Jim.
Yeah. Well, Carol made that clear in Wrath of Khan. She didn't want David running off and joining Starfleet.
Yeah.
So, but.
But you see, this is and that bothers me too, because how do you convince your kid not to run off and join Starfleet? Well, one way is to make what you want him to do more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Or two, you villainize Starfleet to the point where they no longer want to.
Yeah.
And in Wrath of Khan, you got the opinion that David had no respect for Starfleet.
No, none whatsoever. Well, they're scientists. And, you know, they think Starfleet is going to come in and take their work away and use it to make weapons with. So, yeah.
So basically, Carol has made what she does more interesting and made Starfleet bad.
Right. What was nice about this, there was one good thing about this, and that is McCoy had a huge problem keeping this information from Kirk.
Yep.
He was very angry about it. And he didn't think it was the right thing to do. And he told Carol, and Carol said, mind your own business. Who's right?
I'm sorry. Did you ask who's right or did you say?
No, who is right? Is McCoy right or is Carol right?
Yes. That's the problem.
Well.
Because it works both ways.
Yeah. Carol's the parent.
Yeah.
And I think she's a little more right than McCoy. McCoy was pushing a little bit hard to get his point across, I thought, because when...
Wait, let me get this straight. You're saying that McCoy was pushing hard on a moral issue? McCoy doesn't do that.
No, imagine that.
No.
But it really is. It really wasn't his place. It's none of his business. Seriously, you know, he is... I would permit him to give his opinion and say what he thinks, and then that's where it stops. It doesn't go on like it did.
And, well, with every other doctor in Starfleet, that's the way it should be, because they're going to give their opinion to their captain, and then the captain's going to make a decision. But this is McCoy, and Kirk has allowed him to let those ideas fester.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't just be given to the captain. McCoy keeps pushing.
Okay.
Now, all the time.
I'm going to suggest that I think Dr. Pulaski in the second season of Next Generation would have been the same way.
Yeah.
because she could become quite the irritant.
But it's not because of Picard letting her do it.
Right.
It was just the nature of Pulaski.
Yeah.
She'd been in two episodes of the original series, and Kirk got to her.
Mm-hmm.
No, not Pulaski, but the actress.
Yeah. You know, and that line that Picard uses after, I don't know, maybe it's a third or fourth episode of the season where he leans over to her and says, "By the way, Doctor, would you please permit me to finish my sentences at least once in a while?"
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite lines in the entire series.
And I think, too, didn't she say that McCoy was one of her teachers?
That I don't remember, but you could be right. Okay, your next point, and this is a sticky one.
Yeah, how do you satisfy two divergent alien cultures about their religious beliefs? Well, the easiest way is you put them on separate planets.
That would be the easiest way, but...
Yeah.
So
aren't we developing terraforming so we could just go to the next planet over, terraform it, and give it to one of the cultures?
Yeah. So let's get into this discussion a little bit deeper. This is the religious part of the story where Ambassador Farquhar has been assigned to go and mediate between two factions on a planet. One faction worships a cow-like animal because in their belief system, the cow-like animals are resurrected souls of their dead. These creatures, I don't even remember what they're called, are allowed to roam freely wherever they want to go.
Yeah, just like the, well, at least what we were taught was just like the cows in India.
Mm-hmm. And nobody is permitted to interfere with where they go in any way, shape, or form. The other side has they have cities and towns, and these animals tend to migrate from time to time one way or the other, and they tend to
through make, the towns.
Yes, they tend to make quite a mess as they pass through these towns, as one might imagine they would. So the people of the town, all they want is for these animals to go around and not through their settlements. I don't think that's too unreasonable.
Except that you can't put up a barrier.
Right.
You can't put up a item to turn the herd that's not natural. You can't. There's so many restrictions.
You can't scare them.
Yeah.
You can't touch them. You can't herd them. You can't do anything or you're going to start a war.
Yeah.
So, and nobody on the planet actually wants that, but unfortunately they don't get their way. So, should we save the solution to that problem for a little later?
No, let's go ahead.
Okay. So, apparently there is a particular flower that grows on Kronos that emits an odor. Ooh. Yeah. Emits an odor that these cows do not like. So
now, I'm wondering if that odor is based on the prevalence that plant has for generating oxygen. Because the reason they have the plant is that the plant was being used by the colonists on the scientific planet to try and generate oxygen for their terraforming efforts.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise... Yeah. It's a Klingon plant. Why would they have it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, they brought one to Sulu, who brought it on board the Enterprise. And, you know, of course, his interest is in botany, and he dearly loved to add that to his collection. Now, we go back to the planet, and Kirk is suggesting solution after solution. Okay. Hey, we can just put up a shield, a harmless shield, to divert the animals one way or the other away from the town. Nope, you can't do that. All right, we can, you know, he came up with several different solutions I can't even remember, and everything was rejected.
Here's another important point. Why was Kirk coming up with them?
Yeah.
Why wasn't the ambassador coming up with them?
Well, exactly. But all the ambassador is going to do is talk. And I'll tell you what, you know as well as I do, when someone gets something in their belief systems, there is no amount of talk that is going to change their mind.
Yeah.
I mean, that history is replete with that example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm resisting talking about vaccines
for
the COVID virus. But...
Let's not get outside our purview here. So none of the solutions that Kirk or is offering or Scotty comes up with and offers, they're not going to be accepted, all right? Or whatever McCoy comes up with. But they come up with this solution that would be, if there's a natural way to do this and it exists on the planet, they can do it. So they grab this plant or this flower off of the Enterprise and bring it down and find out that the cow-like creatures don't like the smell. And they go the other way, voluntarily.
Yeah, which kind of makes me wonder, what the hell's going on with this religion when a odor that can be generated by other means is no-go, but if it's generated by a plant, it's okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't a rose by any other name still smell the same?
Yes, it does. But it is a natural solution that they accept. Now, it's not the nature of that particular planet, but it is not manufactured, which makes it apparently acceptable.
Yeah.
I kind of chuckled at the solution to the problem myself. Because this plant is not natural, is not part of the nature of the planet that the cattle live on, but it is part of the nature of another planet. So,
and how fast are they going to reproduce this plant?
In the cities, they're going to reproduce it as quickly as possible, I'm sure.
How? Think about that question for a second. Because the only way that this falls under the natural blend is by collecting the seeds and planting them and allowing it to grow slowly over time.
Yeah. Well, we'll just use replicators and not tell the other guys about it.
Yeah, see, there you go. We're going to trick the hell out of them.
Why not? I mean, you know, we're just trying to avoid a war here so we can get back and help protect the very new G7 Genesis device. You know, religious issues...
That we don't know is being attacked by Klingons yet.
Yeah. Religious issues are sticky, you know, and an organization like the Federation needs... I think they need to study history a little more and interfere a little less. Just my take on things.
Yeah. And your take is probably more reasonable because my take has always been, to heck with religion.
Nah. Well, that's not very diplomatic now, is it?
No, but then I never said I was a diplomat. I'm not a Federation ambassador.
Ah, all right. Well, moving right along.
Apparently aren't very diplomatic, so.
Yeah.
Maybe I should be a Federation ambassador.
No. Yeah. Klingon ambassador, at least.
Yeah.
Your next bullet point.
How can Spock keep the research scientists' children safe from the Klingons? Well, Spock ought to have a lot of arrows in his quiver because he's pretty bright and he's dealt with the Klingons a lot and he's seen some things that work and some things that doesn't and has the training to back it up.
Mm-hmm. But he becomes a scoutmaster.
Right off the bat.
He becomes a scoutmaster.
Yeah, pretty much.
I was expecting them to build a fire and start singing Kumbaya.
We never did that in the Scouts.
Oh, well. Don't pass that around because I think that's one of the big recruiting points, right?
I don't know. We never sang that song or even talked about it. And I think if we were told that we're going to go out in the woods and build a fire and sing Kumbaya, we'd all quit.
Okay.
Maybe. We were tired of the nuns back in school making us sing those damn songs.
Oh, well, maybe you could sing the Happy Wanderer. Are you,
okay, whatever that is.
Oh, you're not familiar with that? Valerie,
nope.
Valdera, Valerie, Valdera, you never heard that?
No, I think I've heard of it somewhere, but again, bye, we quit.
No, now, that's a fun song to sing, though. Tell you what, I wouldn't quit. I'd sing it. But... Then again,
well, the thing is, I got bitched out by the nuns in grade school for keeping my voice down because I didn't think I had a very musical voice and was trying not to screw up the rest of the harmony.
Oh, well, I guess. All right. Spock and the children.
He should have lots of techniques that he should use. And he goes and digs a hole.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there other ways he could have got around behind the Klingons and done whatever he was going to do instead of, you know, trapping himself?
Yeah, I don't know. It was interesting. Spock's ideas. He got the job done.
He got the job done when he was doing it by himself.
Well, and then
when he teamed up with the kids, boom, he's caught.
Yeah, and then a little later, he even had a Klingon helping him.
Yeah.
So, and poor Klingon, he got in a little trouble for that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Your next bullet point.
Knowing Krug, how will he exact his revenge on the scientists once he has command?
He doesn't.
Okay, nothing else. Okay, Krug is running off with the ship. He knows that Kirk is not going to stay with the planet. He could just come right around and do whatever he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know,
Krug is not a quitter. I don't see Krug as a quitter.
Well, he didn't. He came back in Wrath of Khan, after Wrath of Khan, in Star Trek III, and raised all kinds of hell.
Yeah.
He had 10 years to plan it.
Yeah, I don't see him being that patient.
Yeah. I guess. He had to climb the ladder, though, in order to get into a position to be able to do that.
Now, if he'd have gotten back to Kronos and they would have relieved him of the command of the ship,
mm-hmm.
that would have been another story.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if they, you know, of course, it never says in there whether he was relieved of command or they put a new command structure in place and promoted Krug for his ingenuity. But we don't know.
Nope.
So there's another book. Okay, Mike, get to work. You got some blanks to fill in there, my friend. All right. And so under some concepts.
Okay, yeah. Terraforming. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I agree. Other than being scientific research or the development of a weapon. As we see in the Star Trek universe, Kirk mentions to the Kelvins who invaded from the Andromeda Galaxy, there are hundreds of planets all over the galaxy. We can find one that is suitable for you, and we can move you there, and we can help you start a colony. Tells the same thing to, Worf and Worf's brother. Move an entire civilization or an entire tribe to another planet to live on when their planet is going to be destroyed. So,
and let's bring this back to reality. You've even got Neil deGrasse Tyson saying terraforming is not a good idea.
Well, it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of money and it takes a lot of resources to do it. Besides,
well, yeah, and if you know what you're doing, do it to Earth and save the Earth.
Yeah, exactly. But when we did get the Genesis device, it wasn't right.
No, they cheated.
Yeah, we had to use protomatter in order to get the thing to work, which made it completely unpredictable.
Whatever protomatter is.
Well, it was a thing that caused the Genesis planet to get all messed up. It's about the only thing I can think to say.
It's like saying, okay, we're going to use dark matter in this device to get it to work.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have no idea what dark matter does. And, well, we don't know that dark matter won't do what we want it to do.
And we don't even know where to find it.
Yeah, we do. It's over there being contained by the dark energy. What do you mean you don't know what dark energy is?
Yes, exactly. All right. Don't know. You asked another one. It says, is the G7 device an early version of the Genesis device? I would say probably it is a stage in the development of the Genesis device. How does it work?
Would it be really interesting is for them to have to, this is another novel now. They're working with the G7 device and they decide it's a dead end. But David finds out that using protomatter starts to get the reactions that he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go.
Yep. And you wind up with a Genesis planet.
Right.
So, and then you ask in here, how does it work? It doesn't matter in this book. There is no reason to even think about that because they don't use it. All it is there's a part of it that is stolen and disappears. Spock hides it to keep it from falling in the hands of the Klingons.
Okay, you say that, but then I have a science degree, and we always want to know how it works.
Which would be fun, but then that would add another, I don't know.
Book.
Another book.
Yeah, add another book.
Right. So then we would have had to do away with the problem on the planet with the sacred cows, and maybe that wouldn't be too bad an idea.
Yeah, see?
Okay, I'm on board.
You just, you know, maybe it just needs to have hamburgers made that the humans, researchers eat, and the ideas come to them from the proteins in the hamburgers.
Okay. That's what you get when you ask a chemist, guys. All right.
We're gonna look to find an idea, even if it is the stupidest thing you've ever heard of.
Well,
but at least it's an explanation.
It's a starting point.
It may be a wrong starting point, but it's a starting point.
It's like I keep telling my kids at school, you know, I'll ask a question. They all stand there and sit there in their chairs and look at me like I'm speaking a foreign language. And it's like,
but you are English,
you know, and then I'll get one or two that raise their hand and come up with these ridiculous ideas. And it's like, hey, you know what? It's okay to say, I don't know. It's totally okay to say, I don't know, because that's the beginning of learning. It doesn't,
yeah.
It's not a reflection on you personally. That's where you start learning with, I don't know.
Every major scientific discovery has started out with that question.
Yes. Well, the entire space program. I'm sure the NASA engineers.
Those are engineers. Those aren't scientists. Those are engineers.
Yeah.
Scientists go, I don't know. Engineers go, I can make that better.
Ah, well, not in the case of after Kennedy said, we're going to go to the moon within the decade, and everybody was standing around scratching their heads wondering, how are we going to do this? And the other half is, I don't know. So, you know, they had 9 years to figure out something that they were expecting to have 20 years to do. So,
I believe, except for one man at that time who knew exactly what he wanted to do, Van Buren.
Oh, Von Braun.
Van Braun, yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
He had already figured out how to go to Mars.
He'd been working on that for a very long time.
Yeah. Hitler was just in his way.
Yeah, pretty much. Hey, I don't want to fight a war here. I want to learn how to go to space. So, favorite points of plot.
Okay. What do I got here? How do we find a stupid solution to a stupid religious problem? It'd be an easy answer if they framed it as property rights issue and not as a religious one.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Yeah. I don't have the answer to that. And
no, because it's a religious problem.
Yeah.
There are no easy answers.
No, there never is when you get into the area of beliefs.
Because religious scholars have to go to such incredibly weird-ass explanations to keep their concepts dogma,
mm-hmm.
to not investigate things and adapt to what reality is. They just got to find some weird-ass explanation to explain crap.
Yeah, yeah. The property rights issue is one I could have gotten behind, but we all know how religious fervor can make the issue even more vicious. And you had another point?
Oh, I wish we would have seen more tricks Spock would have used on the Klingons because, you know, I mentioned earlier, he's got all these arrows in his quiver. Use some of them.
Mm-hmm.
He knows enough history. He's got enough solutions to problems. He's combat trained. He knows how to deal with non-combat trained people.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. He could have done more things to mess up the Klingons.
Yeah.
And if he did, here's the thing that you might go along with. If he did that, we'd be spending less time with those religious idiots.
Yeah, could be. Right. So anyway, we got some themes. I think we've talked that first one to death. I think we should move on.
Don't I wish.
I think we've talked that one enough.
No, I was hoping to have talked it to death.
Oh, well, I'm killing it right now. Violently. All right. So your second point, though, is very relevant.
Why are they running a science project of this magnitude so close to enemy territory? Was this the only planet in their part of the quadrant that had the potential to work from it?
And that's a great question. Let's go right up to the doorstep of the Beta Quadrant, get right on the Klingon Federation border, and start working on some top secret science. And then just kind of sit around and hope the Klingons don't show up.
Right, right.
Didn't work.
Yep, they're not interested in anything we're doing.
No, of course not.
Nope.
Yeah. And your last point of theme?
Something new is added to the Klingon mythos in this book.
Mm-hmm.
A cultural bigotry between various, I want to say, sects of groups of Klingons, because you've got one set of Klingons that are named that are not thought of real well by another set of Klingons that are named, and this is the first we've really heard about it. It kind of borders on the prejudice that we saw between the smooth head and ridged Klingons,
right,
in other books,
or in for instance the Kor versus Martok idea, where Kor was high born and Martok was low born and had to fight his way to become a command rank.
Yeah, but this is more like the episode "Let This Be Your Last Battleground," where you've got weird ass distinctions. You're black on the right side and I'm black on the left side,
right?
And that's why I'm better than you.
Yeah. Yep. That was a risky episode in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What was interesting...
But they got away with it because they didn't talk about black and white issues. They talked about the same people having two-tone faces.
Uh-huh. And they were aliens.
Yeah, well...
You know, there's a lot of social issues that come up in science fiction that are out there blatantly put on display, but it's very discreet... Not, I shouldn't say very discreet, but it is able to be done because we're talking about alien.
Yeah, and the problem is that science fiction readers see what the author is getting at, where the editors of the book or the judges of the society miss the issue completely because the author has hidden it so that only the people who are immersed in the genre we'll see the depths that he's gone to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Many, many times. That's one of the reasons that science fiction is so good. We can actually talk about the things that need to be talked about without actually offending anyone.
Technically speaking, Westerns were the same way. Westerns were, again, morality plays.
Mm-hmm.
But the issues were framed in frontier survival and went over the heads of some people, that people who are aficionados of the genre would see them right off the bat.
Uh-huh. All right, and let's move into our closing thoughts. You go first.
Okay. It's a fun, easy read, except for the fact that it's an e-reader, and offers some insight into Klingon cultural diversity. Like I said, the schisms that they talk about a little bit, they talked about them and they kind of dropped them. But, and we never see the topic again in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like that doesn't detract from the fact that it's an easy read. It's a fun read. It's a nice ride. Take it.
It's a Mike Friedman book.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's still a fun read, no matter what.
His stuff is always fun. Everything he has written that I have read has been just an absolute joy to read. So, as a matter of fact, I've got a brand new anthology by him called Phenomenons. It's about superheroes that I just got received and going to be reading that pretty soon. Okay, so it seems like a lot of fill-in-the-blanks book focusing on explaining things in Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock, which is something I appreciate. I don't mind backstory at all. It's really, really kind of fun. So
that, as long as it's not, I don't know, it seems to me that if you're going back too far for characters that are not going to be consequential going forward, it kind of misses the point, but that's me.
Well, now let's think about that for a minute, right?
I did.
Maltz, Krug ordered Maltz to kill one of the prisoners, and he didn't care which one. Which prisoner did Maltz choose?
Which did he choose? The one that was written in the script.
He chose, okay, now you're copping out on me. He chose.
Not really.
He was going.
Because
he, was
he chose
going,
the male.
He, no, he did not. Maltz did not. He was going to stab Savick, and David intervened, which got him killed.
Okay.
Yeah. Go back and watch the movie. So had David not been there, had something happened to him on this planet while he was working on the Genesis device or whatever, he wouldn't have been there to save Savick. So there.
Okay.
Okay. All right. That is Faces of Fire.
I hate to break this to you, but he's dead, Jim.
Yeah. Well, he was never really alive, John. He's a character in a movie.
but the line is, he's dead, Jim.
Yes. All right. So on our next very exciting episode of Bound by Honor, we are going to read and discuss Star Trek The Lost Era 2328 through 2346, The Art of the Impossible by Keith R.A. DeCandido. We keep finding Keith's books, and I'll tell you what, I'd be happy to just continue to do that.
Unfortunately, we keep finding them, but they're going to run out.
I know they're going to run out.
We talked with Keith some months ago, and he was saying that the Star Trek editors are not letting him write Star Trek books anymore.
No, yeah, they're not signing him on for that. I don't know why, but Keith's very happy writing his stuff, and you know, he's doing
very well.
He spent
a lot of time doing research, so you know, he has enough backstory to keep going. It's a shame that they're not taking advantage of that.
Well, who knows? Maybe something will change. So you can find us all over the place to listen to CAG.org. We are on Apple Podcasts. We are on Google Play. You can pass that along to your friends, your neighbors, your enemies, whomever you'd like, and shout it from the rooftop. So get us some more listeners.
But wait for the winter storms to die off, because, you know, being up on those rooftops, you're not Superman. You will fall off the roof. Jumping off the roof is not going to make you fly.
No.
So,
no.
Be careful.
Not at all. You're not Mick Foley. Okay. So, for Bound by Honor, I am Jim.
And I am Jorn.
And join us next time. Kapla! You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!